Hi, everybody. My name's Otto, and I'm an alcoholic. Excited to be in the great state of Georgia. Never, ever did I dream when I came to AA I would be standing at a podium in a hall as glorious as this. What a plate. Man, you guys do it upright. Pretty fancy. Pretty fancy. And I tell you, it's nice to look out and see so many faces, too. That's real comforting. I spoke at my home group not long ago, and 8 people came. So, y'all don't know what you're in for. But it's nice to be here. I brought my pretty wife with me. I'd like to introduce her. It's my wife, Pat. Stand up and wave at them, Patsy. Thank you, dear. Stand up and wave at them. She's mad at me. Again. She usually brings a sign that she keeps with her when I'm speaking, and it says, it's a big sign, and it says, he's lying. She keeps me honest with that. Well, you know, I finally convinced her that to me it's not a lie. You know, I just have a different rendition of the truth than she has. So we're working on getting her a sign that says that's not the way I remember it. I know why you guys got all out-of-state speakers too, because I don't know how y'all understand one another talking Georgian. You know, I like to never got checked in over there. We had a flat tire coming in, and this old boy stopped and helped us. He's a good old boy. And he's in a pickup truck pulling a trailer. And I never did understand a word he said, but he did get a tire changed. So I know that the good old boys in Georgia are good old boys. Anyway, I'm pleased to be here, and I'm happy to share my story with you. I think it's a wonderful story, especially since I'm on this side of it. You know, when I was on the other side of it, God, it sucked. It was awful. And does anybody play the harmonica? Got any harmonica players in here? One of these days I'm going to find a harmonica player. I'd really like to have somebody up here while I'm talking playing Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. You know, just real softly on a harmonica behind me, just kind of as an accompaniment, you know. Because it's a sad, sad story. I mean, I'm a sad alcoholic. Anyway, I got sad. It started back in Oklahoma. I grew up in Oklahoma. Was raised there. Lived most of my whole life in Oklahoma. Live in Dallas now, but I've been there 9 years. But till then, I lived in Oklahoma. And I grew up in a family of 6 in a little tiny house. And I was affected by alcoholism before I ever took my first drink. Because both my parents drank to excess. And they fought and raised hell and didn't get along very well. They married and divorced each other 3 times before I got out of high school. They couldn't live with each other. They couldn't live without each other. And my father was a violent man. And I can remember hearing my mother scream and seeing my father beat my mother into bloody pools. And it was really confusing because my father was a policeman. So it's kind of a strange image, you know, when he's the law and he's the authority and he's an abusive alcoholic. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. He's just my dad. That's a novel idea, isn't it? A lid for a bottle. As Dan, I don't know about you guys, but when I open a bottle, the cap goes that way. I didn't get time to put the lid back on. Take it off. Put it back on. Might intend to. Anyways, the drinking was commonplace where I grew up, and I never saw it as queer. I never saw drunkenness as queer. I really never saw bad behavior as queer. My dad worked 2-3 jobs trying to support the family, and if I wanted to see my dad or spend any time with him, well, I'd go down to the tavern because that's where he was when he wasn't working, and I pretty much grew up in the tavern setting, and I liked it. You know, I liked to go down. I felt really cool as a young kid, 8, 10, 12 years old, hanging out at the tavern, shooting pool and playing horse collar and shuffleboard and dominoes, and the bookies would come in, and we'd play those parlay cards, and, you know, I just thought I was pretty cool. And the drunkenness and the carrying on and the discord and the tumbling out the doors fighting and stuff, I never thought there was just anything odd about that. That's just what people do, isn't it? And if we had a party at my house, well, it would always had a keg floating out back. And so drinking and getting drunk were just commonplace. And so when I began to drink and get drunk, there was nothing odd about it, at least not to me. I've had many people throughout my life, my adult life, tell me, Otto, you drink too much. Otto, you eat too many pills. And I'd tell them, no, I don't. You don't understand. That's my pat answer. You don't understand. See, you don't understand. No, I don't. And when I would tell them, no, I don't, I was telling the truth. That was my truth. In the world according to Otto, I don't drink too much. I drink just barely enough. You know, if I didn't have it, well, all I got, well, it wouldn't be enough. And I remember a fellow asking me once, he says, Otto, how many pills did you do? And I told him, I said, well, I always did all I had. And that's the right answer for an addict like me. I like to wear those 501 blue jeans that have that little pocket on the front. And I'd fill that up with my dope. And then I could reach in there and just eat pills all day. Nobody, I thought, knew what I was doing. Putting those in my mouth, breathing, going, you know, and somebody would say, what you got there? And I tic-tac. Tic-tac, I got a mint. Can I have one? No. Nope, that's the last one, I'm sorry. I ain't one to share. But I never saw myself as having a problem, and really that's kind of been my issue my whole life, is I've responded to the world that I see as if it's real, and as if it were the world that is, as opposed to just my perspective or my understanding or my idea. I'm a selfish, self-centered person, and the world revolves around me, and any deviation from the way I think, feel, believe is how far off base you are. I'm kind of the standard unit of measure. I'm plumb. I'm where the middle is. And I never had an idea that maybe you just saw things differently than I see them. If I enjoyed something, well, I thought you should enjoy it. I'm the kind of guy that would go in a grocery store or into a Target or a 7-Eleven or I don't know what kind of stores you have here, a Walmart. Everybody's got a Walmart, okay? I go into a Walmart and I'd be looking for a Christmas present or something. I'd be in the toy department and I'm looking at toys and there'll be other couples and people in there shopping and I'll be telling them which toys that their kids will like. And they didn't ask. But you see, I know. I know everything. I'm all knowed up. I've been knowed up for a long time. I wasn't allowed to not know. Where I grew up, there were some rules. You know, practice makes perfect. Where there's a will, there's a way. If anyone can, you can. Quitters never win, and winners never quit. Exceptions are made for exceptional people. Always give a man a good hand. Big boys don't cry. You want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. Always tell the truth. Don't you lie to me. And so I tried to live by those rules, but they didn't work. They just didn't work for me. I found out that more often where there was a will, there was a conflict. And I'd be trying to get my way, and it wasn't working. And I wanted to cry. And I wanted to tell my dad the truth. You know, I wanted to tell Dad, it scares me when you hit Mom. But I couldn't tell my father that. I learned early on, you don't tell Dad the truth. You tell Dad whatever he wants to hear. And I learned quick to watch. And as I would speak or try to communicate with my father, I could watch his face and I'd know if I was going the right way or not. And I could change in the middle of the stream, Republican and Democrat, just in the middle of a sentence. Just trying to figure out, what do I have to do to get my dad to like me, to get my dad to let me survive another day? And I was excited to get out of that house. In high school, I was safe. You know, home was hell. High school was safe. And so in high school, I was kind of a Mr. Everything. I was a bit of a show-off. I was class president and top teen, and I was in student council and emceed the pep rallies and headed up to paper drives, and I played all the sports and was voted the friendliest boy in school, and the teachers gave me gifts when I graduated. You'd never know what a stud I was, unless you ask me. And But I always had to come home. And so I started drinking when I was about a junior in high school, because when I would take a drink, even though I didn't particularly like it, when I'd take a drink, all the tension and all the chaos and all the fear that existed in my home would seem to dissipate. And it didn't seem to matter anymore. It wasn't so bad living in that home. And I began to use that as a tool everywhere I went. If I had to give a speech at school, well, you know, a couple of drinks would help me to relax so I could give a better speech. And it became a tool that I used, and I thought it served me well. I think the non-alcoholic could probably have a drink, take the edge off, and maybe do a good job. But that didn't work for me because I'm an alcoholic. You see, that started a progression in me that when I drink, I'm not quite sure when I'm going to stop. And there were many a times that I started to have that drink to help make things better, and I ended up with things a whole lot worse. And I never could understand why. I was a blamer. And if things didn't go my way, well, I had somebody to blame, and it was never me, and it was never alcohol. I can remember being married to two real nice ladies. I destroyed two perfectly good marriages because I wasn't happy, and it must be their fault. It never occurred to me that my drinking might be a problem. I'm having a little trouble getting going today. It's just not flowing out. Da-dee-da-dee-da. This is a special day for me. I'm pumped to be here. Anyway, okay. It'll come to me. Hang on. Anyway, I drink. I like to drink. I drink a lot. Drink often. And I'm the kind of drinker that doesn't get up and go to work the next day. You know, because I've been drinking the night before. And I tell everybody I gotta get to sleep, because I gotta get up and go to work tomorrow. I didn't go today. And I didn't go yesterday. And the reason I didn't go is because I can't get to sleep. And so I have to have a drink to help me get to sleep. Now, is anybody new or nearly new here? Oh, thank you, please. I'm so glad to see your hands. If you're like me, when you're new or nearly new, sleep's kind of hard to come by in the beginning. You know, those 30 meetings in 30 days and those 1,000 nights in the 30 days? I would go. The meetings were great for me, but I'd go home and the nights were forever. Because, see, I don't sleep. I've never slept well. And I always thought that I drank and ate those pills to help me get to sleep. And when they said, Otto, you drink too much, I couldn't imagine how I was going to go to sleep at night without my pills and my drink. I remember I had a nurse one time when I was in the hospital, and I said, you know, I really need something to help me get to sleep. And she said, well, Otto, you'll sleep when you get tired. She don't understand. See, here's another one that don't understand. And I tried to explain to her all these reasons I had why I can't sleep. You know, when I was a kid, my mom and dad would fight, and I couldn't sleep, worrying in bed, laying there waiting for them to come home. And then I went off to college, and I was in a fraternity, and there was a lot of pranks at night and partying going on late at night, and I couldn't sleep. And then I went in the military, you know, and in the military we lived in these big barracks with these bunks and 60 guys living in a barrack, you know, and they didn't have stalls on the bathroom doors, and it was terrible. And you lay in bed at night, and you hear the old... I don't know what these guys are doing to themselves, but I can't sleep. And I've never been able to sleep. And then I went off to Vietnam and as an infantryman, and I promise you, being in the infantry in Vietnam in 1968 as a serviceman was not a pleasant experience. And I can remember being over there in the monsoon season, and it's raining, and the clouds would roll in at night, and there's no moonlight, and there's no starlight, and there's triple canopy jungles up where I'm at in the highlands, and it's so dark you can't see your hand in front of your face. But I'd look out into that darkness, and I could see the enemy. I can't see my hand, but I'd see them out there making faces at me. You know, I mean, and I was scared to death, and I couldn't sleep. See, you don't understand. And then I was wounded in a air assault. I walked up on an enemy position, and I was shot twice. And they dusted me off and sent me to a hospital in Yokota, Japan, and I was there for 7 weeks. Then I went to a hospital in California, a hospital in Texas. Finally wound up at a hospital, Reynolds Army Hospital in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And I was there for a long time. When I turned 21, I'd been in the hospital 4 months, and when I turned 22, I was still laying there. That's a long time to be bedridden. you know, and the bed's not a nice place for me. I don't sleep well. I'm not comfortable being in bed. I have this terrible disability, and I can't get comfortable in the bed. I sleep with like 10 pillows, and where's that harmonica? You know, and I can't get to sleep. And I'm trying to explain this to this nurse. And she says, "Oh, Otto, nobody ever died from a lack of sleep." And I thought, well, you might. You just might die if I don't get some sleep, you know. The fact of the matter is, I was just scared to death. Just scared to death of what I was going to do without alcohol and drugs. I had lost my job. I was unemployed, unemployable because of the way I drank. I couldn't get up and go to work in the morning. I couldn't go to sleep at night without drinking myself into a stupor. I'm the kind of drinker that has to have a drink before he goes out to drink. You know, I never went to a party sober. I had to get a few drinks before I go out to drink. I used to carry a flask with me everywhere I went. Or not a flask, several flasks. I had a variety of flasks, and I had them decorated so that it wouldn't, you know, I was the kind of person who tried to make fun of everything, make light of everything. And so rather than have you go, "What the hell are you doing with the flask here?" I would have some kind of cute art painted on it so that people would think it was appropriate for the situation. And, you know, if we went to the races and I pulled out a flask, they don't sell whiskey at the races, the car races. And, well, I'd have checkered flags painted on it and a little sign that says "Racing Fuel." And we'd all have a laugh and I'd have a belt, you know. And we'd go bowling I didn't want to pay what they'd pay in the club for a drink, you know, and those well drinks are awful, and pay $3-4 for a well drink. Well, there's no way. I like to drink good bourbon. And so I'd take me a flask, and on it I'd have a big red cross. And because of my disability, well, it hurts me a little bit. So, you know, I had this medicinal purposes flask, and I'd drink out of that at the bowling alley. And never saw my drinking as queer. Never saw that there was a problem whatsoever. And I know that many of you have tried time and time again to quit drinking and stay quit. And my heart goes out to you, but I can't empathize at all because, see, I never, ever tried to quit. I could not imagine quitting drinking and drugging. My life was just too painful. When I didn't drink and when I didn't drug, I had withdrawals. You know, my life was like fingernails on a chalkboard when I wasn't drinking. If I'd go a day or two without a drink, it was just, "How you doing, Otto?" "Yeah, this is nice." So the idea of not drinking never occurred to me. Never did. I would go to a party and somebody's home and we'd drink until 2 o'clock in the morning, and then everybody'd go home and they'd say, "Otto, we want you to stay over." Well, I couldn't stay over because I wasn't done drinking. I don't drink like they drink. They drink, you know, have a few drinks, and they have a party, and then they go home. Well, I drink until the drinking's done. I drink until the bed spins. I'm the kind of drunk that has to throw one leg off the side of the bed, try to get the room to stop. I'm a puking drunk. I drink until I poison myself, and I have to get rid of it, or I'm going to die. And I never, ever saw myself as having a problem. I could always blame it on something else. I have a story I like to tell about towards the end of my drinking. You know, people talk about denial. It doesn't talk about denial in our book. I don't think. I believe it talks about delusion. And the difference between denial and delusion is delusion is your truth, that the truth isn't real. Denial is kind of like, you know, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Monica Lewinsky, Miss Lewinsky." That's denial, okay? That's when you're doing one thing and saying another. But when people would say, "Otto, you got a drinking problem," I say, "No, I don't. That was my truth." See, and that's delusion. Because 2 and 2 didn't add up to 4 in my life. I'd gone to the car races down in Florida. I love the car races. I grew up across the street from the dirt track in Oklahoma City. And racers have been my heroes my whole life. So I just love to go to the car races. And I go down to Daytona for speed weeks. And you guys have some racing around here, don't you? And go to all the little dirt tracks, Volusia County and all them, go to the races while we're down there. And I met some boys, and we're traveling around and drinking beer and having a good time and going to the races. And, I remember one day we were at the Tampa Fairgrounds at the state fair was going on in Florida, and we were drinking that cold beer and watching the cars go in circles and having a good time. And then we left the races after they were over and the fair's going on. So we walked around the fairgrounds and threw balls at Cupid dolls and scoped out the girls and ate corny dogs and strawberries. And then we went to a nightclub. And I love the nightclub because I love to dance. And you all may not know it. I may not look like a dancer, but I can dance, okay? And when I get to dancing, and I've got a few drinks in me, I know all you girls want me, okay? I know you do. And so I didn't mind having a drink. I danced by myself. Just because you all know how cool I am. Okay? Anyway, I've been drinking 12, 14 hours this day. And eating those little pills out of my pocket, and I did like I oft times did, and that was I got sick. And you know, I don't think the normal moderate temperate drinker might get sick once. And then they learn that, you know, that's too much, and they don't go there again. But I got sick all the time. And I remember staggering out of this club that night, and I'm sick. Anybody ever do that? If you've done this, you know what I'm talking about. You know, it's cold outside, but you're sweating. And I'm holding on to the cars, and I'm holding on to the side of the building so I don't fall down. Just a weaving. And I know what's coming because it's just a turning. Pretty soon. That stuff is just blowing out of my face. It's on my pants. It's on my boots. It's on the car. I'm still cool. But I got little pieces of corn dog stuck up my nose. There's corn dog stuck up my nose. Go back in the club, get me another drink. I got to wash that taste out of my mouth. It tastes awful. Tell my buddies, whew, God, oh, I got sick. You wouldn't believe it. I got sick. I swear, as long as I live, I'll never, ever, ever eat another state fair corn dog. That greasy damn thing made me sick. You know, and that made perfect sense to me. 2 and 2 is 4. That's up. That's down. And that corn dog made me sick. You know, I didn't have enough sleep. I'm under too much stress. I didn't eat enough dinner. There was always a reason for why I got sick. There was always a reason. You know, I'm the kind of guy who was always late. No matter where I'm going, I'm late. And it was never my fault. You know, there was too much traffic. There was a jam. The weather changed or whatever. You know, but I'm late. And I could never own the fact that, you know, I was unwilling to leave early. I never allowed for the fact that our lives are unmanageable and our best plans don't work. And sometimes stuff happens and you can't get there on time. So therefore, you need to leave a little bit early. Well, I couldn't imagine leaving early because I wasn't willing to get there and sit for 5 minutes waiting for my appointment. I wanted to walk in right when it happened. Selfish and self-centered. I had a very distorted sense of self and what life was supposed to be about. And when you live in that confusion and you live in that chaos and when your family's as nuts as mine is, you know, the family tradition has carried on long besides me and long after my parents. I've got two brothers. One of them hanged himself in prison while there for drugs. I've got another little brother. He's in prison as I speak, as I stand before you. He's in prison for the third time. It's not uncommon for the police to be called to my mother's house today for my nephews and whatnot. I remember a few Christmases ago, they were there Christmas morning at my mom's house. So in all this chaos and all this insanity, before I had a program of recovery, I promise you, a drink was a necessity. You know, I could not function in the world I was living in as I saw it without a drink. The only problem was, You know, I'm becoming more and more isolated, more and more alienated. I'm unemployed and unemployable. I don't see my children anymore. I'm mad at everybody. I don't know about you guys. I just seemed like I was mad at everybody. And I wound up at the VA hospital in a psychiatric ward. They call it the day hospital because they let you go home at night. And then you have to come back the next day. And I was in this hospital, and they diagnosed me as alcoholic, which, you know, I just couldn't imagine. But they suggested that I go to a treatment center. And the only reason I was willing to go, I didn't think I had to go, but I was willing to go because I was having some problems with Valium. Now, I have ate a lot of pills in my adult life, and most of them were prescribed. Most of them. I was a dock worker. Anybody in here a dock worker? That means you go to Dr. A and he gives you pills, and you go to Dr. B and he gives you pills, and you go to Dr. C and he gives you pills, and if Dr. A don't know what Dr. C's giving you, you can get a lot of pills, and that's a dock worker. Don't have nothing to do with boats. So I've eaten a lot of pills, and I'd been to a lot of therapists. You know, I'm pretty unhappy. I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't very happy when I got here. And my life wasn't very enjoyable, and I just couldn't figure out why. I knew it was my Vietnam experience, it was my childhood, it was these broken marriages, it was my disability, it was all these things were just killing me. And so I'm going to therapists and counselors, and I'm going to biofeedback therapy and pain management classes, and I'm doing all these things. I did everything I knew to do to try to get happy. And it wasn't working, and the doctors would prescribe a lot of different medications for me that I thought were supposed to make me happy. And one was Valium, and Valium worked really good for a while. I used to love to take Valium because I could, like, have a fight with my wife and not even raise my voice. With Valium, I was just on even all the time. You know, I've only known two emotions my whole adult life, you know, happy and pissed, okay? But with Valium, I could find a middle ground, and I could just kind of mellow along, just kind of hum along. And we'd have a fight or disagreement, and she'd be hollering and carrying on, and I'd be talking to her just like I'm talking to you. And it was wonderful, because I thought I had it together. Look at you. Look at you carrying on, jumping around, hollering and screaming. Look at you. Why can't you be like me? I like that Valium. Only problem was, I was taking a little more than prescribed, and I was always running out. And I don't know about you, but if you've ever been hooked on Valium and you run out, it gets real damned uncomfortable. You know? I mean, when I would run out of Valium, my hair would stand up and my fingers would curl up and my neck would knot up and I couldn't swallow. You know, I'd try to swallow and it'd just get stuck right there and I can't drink water. You know, and man, I might be addicted to Valium. I've heard it on TV. That, you know, there's a lot of people taking Valium and that some of them are getting addicted. And I thought, well, you know, I might have a problem with Valium. So I was willing to go to treatment under the condition that, you know, I would get off Valium and get on something else. You know, I figured they'd put me on Xanax or something, you know, to replace the Valium because this Valium's kicking my ass. And so that's why I went to treatment. I never, ever had a clue that I had a drinking problem. You know, I mean, I thought I wasn't like my father because I never beat my wife or my kids. You know, my dad was a very battering, abusive man. And I never hit my wife and I never hit my kids. Therefore, I'm not like my father. I thought that's what made me different. I've come to know in recovery I was just like my father. Well, what happened was I went into treatment and I got a beautiful gift. First, I got detoxed, a medical detox, which I very much needed after all the medications I'd been taking. And then secondly, I got introduced to you folks. Because people were coming up to the hospital and they were doing 12-step work. And they'd come up and they'd tell their stories very much like I'm telling mine today. And it was the first time in my life I ever met people that I couldn't look them right square in the eye and say, you don't understand. See? Because you all did. And I knew you did. The problem had been all along, the good people who had tried to help me before you had always tried to tell me about me. And see, you can't tell me about me because you don't understand. You don't know. You haven't had your ass blowed off. You ever heard that expression, I'm going to blow your ass off? They did it. And, you know, I just always felt different. You know, nobody understands me. But when I heard you folks tell your stories, what happened was you talked about yourselves. And in listening to you talk about yourself, I was able to identify myself. And to me, that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I found out that all my secrets, all my shame, all the things I was afraid to own, all the things I was afraid to tell anybody about, you all spoke about with great candor. You all spoke about with great ease. You know, and by golly, you sure sounded like your lives were a lot like mine. And I couldn't even use my disability as an excuse because there was a fellow that came up to the hospital who tried to kill himself. And he did it by asphyxiation. He turned the gas onto his stove and just sat down and was going to die. And what happened was his life's unmanageable and his best plans don't work, so his house blew up. And it just burned him all to pieces. You know, he's got his fingers burned off. He didn't have any fingers on his hands and his skin's all disfigured and whatnot. And he stood up there and talked about being alcoholic and being happy and living with this pain that he has. And I thought, it was just the damnedest thing I ever saw, because he was the only guy that, you know, he even had the physical maladies that I had. And so I could see that he had something that I wanted. And for me, when it finally clicked, you know, bam, I'm an alcoholic. It was good news. It was good news. I mean, I've been looking for an answer my whole life to why am I not able to wrestle some success and some happiness out of my life. Why? I mean, I've done everything I know to do. I've won awards. I've won citations. I'm decorated. I mean, I've got presidential citations. I've married beautiful women. I've had good jobs. I've got an education. I just cannot understand why my life isn't more successful. I've changed everything I know to change. I've changed careers, hobbies, hangouts, wives, friends, music. I changed everything I knew to change, and I couldn't get happy. And then you guys came and spoke at the hospital, and damn, there was the answer. I'm alcoholic. And I got excited. I'm excited. Matter of fact, you know what? I think my dad's alcoholic. And I think my mom's probably alcoholic, and my brother's alcoholic. Damn, Mom, Dad, come on over here. Guess what? I think we're all alcoholics. Come on. They got a program of recovery right over here. No, come on. Where are you going? Come on. They didn't come on. I don't know why. They didn't get it. They weren't there to hear that story. But anyway, I got it. And I was on fire. I was excited. All right. What are we going to do? You know, what's this program of recovery? And they began to outline it for me. You know, things had not changed. Now, I quit drinking and I quit drugging when they got me detoxed. But I promise you, life was still... You know, and as long as I was in that nice, safe, protected environment of that treatment center, the fingernails didn't squeak quite so loud. But you let me go out on a pass and be with my parents. You know, you let me go home and look at that stack of bills or the phone ring. It's awful. You know, what am I going to do? And y'all said, well, we have a program of recovery. You know, what you have to do is you have to work these 12 steps, and you go to meetings, and you get your support group, and your life will change, and the squealing of the fingernails on the chalkboard will slowly go away. And you promised me that. Well, I was willing to do anything, and I am an overachiever and a perfectionist. I thought those were attributes when I came to you. I was just come dragging into treatment, you know, and he said, Otto, isn't there anything good about you? No. I said, well, we want you to go back to your room and think about it. You come back and you tell us three things good about you. I've got nice hair. And I'm an overachiever and a perfectionist. I thought they were attributes. Gee whiz. Anyway, we set out on this program of recovery, and I was going to get me a sponsor and read this book and read your big book and... go to these meetings. I didn't like the meetings. That was a long hour in the beginning. God, those meetings seemed like they're 6 hours long. You know, I didn't really want to be there. And then work the steps. I said, you know, I looked at the steps. They got them up there on the wall. You know, first they admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. And that step was such a gift to me. Because up until that point in my life, at age 37, I had always just thought that I was a screw-up. That I'm a screw-up. You know, I'm not smart enough. I'm not fast enough. I'm not wealthy enough. I'm not clever enough. I'm not quick enough. I'm not strong enough. That's why I'm not able to be more successful in life. You know, I had no idea that our lives are unmanageable and that I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, that it wasn't a shortcoming for me. You know, it was a status. You know, every life is unmanageable, I've come to know. And that's a real relief for coming from a family where practice makes perfect. You can do anything you put your mind to, and there's a will, there's a way. I take a lot of comfort in knowing that, you know, I just take my best shot, and how it turns out is how it turns out. And that sometimes it's just not going to work, and I don't have to beat myself up for it. And the way that was explained to me that made sense to me was my sponsor says, Otto, he says, the lion that can't catch the little deer, his life's unmanageable. And the little deer that can't outrun the lion, his life's unmanageable. You know, and everybody's just doing the best they can, but you don't always get your way. And that's the unmanageability in our lives. And that made sense to me, and so I could go from there. And it kind of helped me to cut myself some slack and let go of that perfectionism. So the first step came pretty easy. And I like the idea of it being a disease and not a weakness. You know, that I was sick instead of bad. That helped me a lot. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. My nickname was Crazy Otto. You know, I had Crazy Otto painted on the back of the race car I owned. And there'd be a column in the racing newspapers, Crazy Otto. You know, I like being Crazy Otto. People don't mess with you when you're crazy. You know? There's a lot of power that comes with being crazy. You know, people don't have a lot of expectations of you when you're crazy. You know, they don't harass you. I mean, a lot of, you know, don't mess with him. He's a Vietnam vet. He's crazy. I kind of like that, you know. gave me a lot of security. Anyway, blew right through two, missed the whole point. Came to three. Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God. God? Look at those steps. God, 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 God damn. It's a God deal. It's a God deal. I was livid. I couldn't believe it. I'd been duped. You know, I should have went to Schick. I should have went to the VA hospital. I should have went somewhere where they can help me. I went to treatment in a Catholic hospital. You go to a Catholic hospital, you're going to get a, you know, Catholic solution. God. Oh, man. I want it out. Let me out. I don't believe in God. If there's a God, I don't want anything to do with Him. If there's a God, He must be a terrorist. One of the old guys was up there doing some 12-step work. His name was Mike. I'll never forget Mike. I talked to him on the phone just the other day. And he says, Otto, what's your problem with God? And boy, could I tell him. I had a long list of things that was wrong with God. You know, when I was a kid and I went to church, I loved the Reverend Bill Alexander, who used to preach at our church. And one Sunday we showed up for church and the Reverend Bill Alexander wasn't there. He had perished in a plane crash the night before. And I could not understand how God's right-hand man could be allowed to perish. And in my family, we didn't talk about those things. You know, I couldn't ask those questions. Why, how could God let Bill Alexander die? And my little brother had colonitis, ulcers of the intestines, the chaos and the stress in the home I grew up in. My little brother was very ill, and he was in a children's convalescent hospital for years. And we'd go out to that convalescent hospital, and there were kids with, you know, cancer, and there were burned kids and deformed kids and thalidomide kids and just all these sick kids out at this hospital, you know. And we'd go back to church and sing, Jesus loves the little children. And I'd think, well, he needs to get his ass out to that convalescent hospital out there. You know, there's some really sick kids out there. But I couldn't say those things. In my house, we didn't talk about those things. I didn't feel like I could ask those questions. And, you know, what was God doing when Hitler was killing all the Jewish people, you know? And what's God doing when there's all these tornadoes and floods and hurricanes and starvation and wars, you know? And Vietnam was such a horrific experience for me. It was really the turning point. I mean, I can tell you when I stopped wondering about God. And it was September 22nd, 1968. You know, we'd gone in on that air assault that I was going to be wounded on, and it was a bad plan from the get-go. We flew into a hot LZ that was too small, and we couldn't get enough men in quick enough. And we were right on top of the enemy, and they were shooting us down. They were having a lot of shoot downs as we came in, and the LZ's blocked, and it's on fire, and there's just a few of us on the ground. And the CO radioed down that he was going to drop firefighting equipment to us and some C4 and see if we couldn't blow down some trees and get some of the fires out so they could get some more help into us. And as his helicopter came hovering over the LZ, you know, here come another rocket out of the trees, hit that helicopter and just blew it right out of the sky. And I'm looking at it trying to watch where he's going to drop that firefighting equipment. And when that rocket hit, this one guy was blown clean out the door. I thought he jumped at first, but I mean, this helicopter is way up at treetop level. And the helicopter just wobbled and fell into the fire. And me and a kid named Henderson, we jumped up and we ran out and we're pulling these guys out of this helicopter. And they're a mess. You know, they're a mess. And the medic's trying to take care of them. And we go looking for this guy that was blown out the door. And he's fallen into the jungle. And we're scavenging around out there while the fighting's going on, not knowing where we're at or where we're supposed to be. And we come upon him and he's a mess. I mean, his legs are blown off. Pieces of his arms are blown off. Most of his face is blown off. You know, but he's alive. I couldn't believe he was alive. And he's gurgling and he's making noises and Jesus, you know. And we drug him back into to the tree line and we used our boot laces to put tourniquets on his legs to stop the bleeding and we put pressure all over him, trying to keep him from bleeding to death and trying to muffle his cries. We don't want him to draw fire. And I mean, I lived with the medic finally got there and took over that, and I left him, never saw him again, never knew who he was. But the images that I had of him haunted me forever. From the time I left Vietnam, the next day when I was wounded, till my whole adult life. You know, I lived with those images. It seemed like when I'd try to lay down at night and go to sleep, if I didn't see my brother twisting on the end of a T-shirt in a jail cell, if I didn't see my father beating my mom, or if I didn't see pictures of that poor soldier blown to pieces, or if I didn't relive those months after months after months of surgeries and laying in the hospital and the pain. Where's God? You know, where's God in all this? And I remember, when I was shot, this is exactly what happened to me the next day. I walked up on an enemy position. I was lost. I was in the jungle. I was separated from my guys, not very far, but in the jungle you don't have to be far to not be able to be seen. And I walked up on an enemy position, and I was going to fall in their hole if they didn't shoot me. And whap, a short burst of machine gun fire rang out, and it just cut me in two. And one round went right through my hip, and the other round went right through my ankle. And my first thought was, I've been shot. I'm so sharp. I'm an alcoholic. I ain't stupid. I've been shot. And my second thought was, God help me. And my third thought was, there is no God. And that's exactly what went through my mind. Those were the first three thoughts I had as I lay there in the jungle floor bleeding to death by myself. The enemy got out of their hole, came and took my watch off my wrist. I had a fresh ruck on. They took a knives and cut the straps off that ruck and pulled it off me and went and got back in their hole, not from me to the end of that table. And I lay there with that gun pointed at the top of my head, and I could feel it. And I was not willing to consider the idea that God could help me. I gave up right then and there, September 22nd, 1968. And I became a self-reliant man. And it wasn't until I got to that treatment center in that hospital that I was presented with the idea again that maybe God could be of service to me. And I wasn't going to buy it. And Mike listened to my story very intently. And he says, Otto, he says, you quit too soon here, buddy. He says, on that third step, it says, God as we understood him. And I don't know where he got the wisdom for these words or who put these words in his mouth, but what he said to me, he says, Otto, you don't have to believe in the God you gave up on in Vietnam that day. And with those words, he gave me a key to get out of the cell I had myself locked into. He gave me a way to get out of the corner I had painted myself into where there was no God. And he asked me this question. He says, what would God have to be for you to take a chance and try and turn your will and your life over to His care, not control? What would God have to be? Now, I thought this was a stupid question. I always thought that I was supposed to figure out, what am I supposed to be so that I can win God's affection, know God's grace? What am I supposed to be? And he's saying, no, what's God supposed to be? What does God have to be for you to do what you got to do?
And I thought that was really queer, but I sat and did some writing overnight, and Mike came back the next day, and I showed him what I had written, and it was, you know, if God was all-powerful, if He could do anything, and with all His power, all He wanted was for me to be sober and like it. Sober and like it. Then I'd be willing to try and turn my will and my life over to His care, not control. I'm not giving up control to nobody. But He can care for me if He'd like. Kind of like if Ross Perot were to come walking in here and go, "Ito, I care for you." I'd be getting excited, see, because Ross has got it going on. Ross has got the Learjet right outside, you know, and Ross can make things happen. So I'd be excited to have Ross care for me, and so I'm going to have God care for me if He's omnipotent and all He wants is for me to be sober and like it. And I fully expected Mike to say, no, that's not what I meant. I need for you to pick a religion. What are you going to be? Baptist, Hindu, Muslim? Come on, what are you going to be? What do you want to be? Pick a team. Don't pick the wrong team. We're killing each other all over the world. But that's not what He said. He says, that's your God. You pray to a God that's all-powerful, and with all His power, all He wants is for you to be sober and like it. Now, this is not going to work. But I was desperate, and He'd given me a way out, and so I was willing to do it. My motives weren't good. My motives were, I'm going to do this, and then when I get drunk, I'm going to sue AA. I promise you, I planned on owning this rich organization. And so I sat about to do everything you told me to do, and I documented it. I had a big calendar, and I documented all my meetings. I documented my phone calls to my sponsor. I couldn't read when I got sober. I'm a college graduate, but I was functionally illiterate. I would look at the pages, and my eyes would move, but nothing was being recorded. And so I'd have the guys I was in treatment with. We'd all get together every day at my house, and we'd read the big book out loud. And I documented it, and I got evidence because they were there. And when I get drunk, I'm suing this place. I might get drunk, but I'm going to be a rich drunk. And y'all know what happened. Because I followed the instructions, even though my motives weren't good, what happened was 30 days passed, and 60 days passed, and 90 days passed, and I hadn't had a drink. You know, I'm getting on my knees, and I'm praying to this God I don't believe in, and I'm not having a drink, and I'm finding you people attractive. You know, and you guys loved me when I wasn't lovable. You loved me till I could love myself, and that's the beauty of AA. Love and service. You all provided a lot of that to me. And I got to where I liked being with you guys. Y'all would take me to lunch, you'd take me to the movies, you'd let me hang out, and I was having a pretty good time. And I had about 8 months sober. And I went on a little trip to the races. I like to go to the races. So I went to the races with some buddies. And I got scared to death. Because everywhere I went, they had free drinks. They had free drinks at the races. They had free drinks at the campers and the trailers. They had free drinks at the hotel where we stayed. You pick up a book of matches and there's free drink coupons on the back. And it's like alcohol was chasing me all around Arizona. And I hurried back home, and that was when I became willing to do a four-step. You know, and I learned some beautiful lessons. I'm not going to go into the details of the steps. I've already talked too long, but when I did the steps, I learned some truths that I had not known to that point in time. I had never been introspective. I had never looked at myself. I had never accepted responsibility for anything. And my sponsor was real gentle leading me through the steps, and he helped me to come to know that my problems are indeed of my own making, and that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem, and that I suffer from a bias and a prejudice of self that has kept me in pain my whole life. You know, and I have been stuck in a place where you need to change so that I can be happy. And the reason I've never been happy is because you all refuse to change. My parents refuse to change. My history refuses to change. The world will not change. And if you guys don't change, I'm screwed. But by working these steps, I was empowered. And I come to find out that if I would change, then everything else changes. You know, it's kind of like a tennis match. I've been playing tennis with life. And when I stopped hitting the ball back, tennis is over. Life can stand over there and swing the racket all they want, but tennis is over, and we're going to play another game. And so when I changed, the whole world changed. And the steps gave me the opportunity to do that. You know, first I found out some truths about myself doing that four-step. I found out how dishonest I was and how deviant I was and how demanding and controlling and lustful and greedy and envious and all those things that I was. Intolerant, impatient. You know, if the lines at the grocery store have to get shorter for me to be happy, I'm screwed. But if I can become more patient and tolerant and understanding, then I can go to the grocery store and the lines won't bother me. And that's kind of the way this thing's worked for me. And as I set about to clean up the wreckage of my past doing 7, 8, and 9, well, then God does for me what I can't do for myself. And this is exactly how it's worked. While I'm out cleaning up the wreckage, the miracles began to happen in my life. And I'm just going to share a few of them with you. You know, I'm happier, healthier, more whole, physically, emotionally, socially, legally, financially, maritally, than I've ever been in my life. I live in a world that I didn't know existed when I came to you. And it's all because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God that truly does do for me what I can't do for myself. You know, and I truly believe that God is all-powerful, and all that He wants for all of us in this room is to stay sober and like it. You know, and we can have that if we're willing to work these steps and do what's suggested. I'd been sober about 8-10 months, and a guy came to me and says, "Would you be my sponsor?" And I said, "Well, I haven't been sober long enough. I'm sorry, I can't be your sponsor." But I was real flattered that he asked. And so I went and told my sponsor. The guy asked me to be his sponsor today. He says, "What'd you tell him?" I said, "I told him no." He says, "Why?" He says, "Well, I don't have enough time." And he says, "What step's he on?" I said, "I think he's on 1. He says, "What step are you on?" I said, 9. "Well, you can go help him with 1 through 8, okay?" "You go find that guy and help him with 1 through 8. And I did. And, you know, that guy stayed sober 10 years. And it was wonderful because I would do for him what I wouldn't do for myself. And I just had this incredible experience trying to help this young man get sober. Because what happened was I found out that I fell in love with him trying to help him. Trying to do for him, I fell in love with him. Knowing him, who he was, and as he was, I found him very lovable. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever known that the love emanates from me, not from you. I had always believed that if you would do it right, I would love you. That if you would behave in such a manner that it would create the warm fuzzy inside of me, then I would love you accordingly. And what I've learned in this program is what you all were doing when I got here. And that is, you loved me when I wasn't lovable. And I went and loved the newcomer when he wasn't lovable, and I fell in love with him. And I knew the joy of loving. And what a beautiful gift that was. And I got to take it home and practice it at home. My father died a few years ago. He never changed. He got worse. Well, he did change. He got worse. You know, my father was never a nice man. My father's the kind of drunk that when we pull up at Christmas with the kids and everybody, he's in the car headed for the tavern on Christmas Day and doesn't even stop to share Christmas with. He's a bad alcoholic. And a few years ago, I buried my father, and I buried a loved one. Not a lovable one. I buried a man that I had known the joy of loving for years. And I learned how to do that in here. He didn't have to change for me to love my father. I became his loving son instead of waiting for him to become my lovable father. I'd been sober about 3 years. I've been sober about 3 years. And my first wife comes to me. She says, "You're doing so good. You take the little bitch before I kill her." And my daughter come to live with me. She was not happy about it. She's coming from a nice house out with the Guess jeans and the Dooney Burke purses and the hot tubs. And I'm living in a little inner city house with no furniture. And, you know, I don't have a dog or a cat or nothing. I mean, I'm just getting by. And, you know, they brought this big canopy bed that she had out there. You know, it wouldn't even fit in the room that I had for her, you know. She was not happy to be there. And I told her, I said, "Holly, I don't know how this is going to work, sweetheart." I said, "I'm just going to love you because I'm your loving father. I'm just going to love you no matter what. I'm going to love you the way people love each other in AA. I'm going to love you the way God loves us all." She was not impressed. She set about to make my life a living hell. And she was going to torture me for everything I'd ever done. I don't know how she got to be such a nasty little girl. I guess she come by it honestly, but you know, I know we're all the perfect products of all our perceived experiences. You know, that we're all perfect. There's nothing wrong with any of us. And that if we were different, then there'd be something wrong. Bad dogs bite. And there's a reason why they're bad. Anyway, I made good on my promise to Holly. I went doubled up on my meetings, like Sandy said. And I started going to Al-Anon. I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups and have been for a long time. I'm what they call in Texas a double winner. And if you're having trouble in your relationships and you've been sober a while and you're not getting along, I invite you to come join us in the Al-Anon rooms, because there we learn how to love one another and detach. and to get along. And it's worked for me. Anyway, after a while, you know, what happened was Holly evolved and she changed. Because I treated her differently, she responded differently. And when I stopped punishing her and demanding of her and telling her how she should be and what she should do, and just helped her to be what she wanted to be and to pretty much let her do what she wanted to do, then what happened was she and I began to have a new relationship. My whole life, my relationships have been like tiddlywinks. You know, I would put pressure on people to be what I thought they should be because I'm so wise. And they would just go, bing, across the room. You know, the more pressure I put on them, the further they would fly. And so when I stopped trying to dictate what people should be and let them be what they wanted to be and help them to be that, then I found out that they found me a lot more attractive. Holly had been with me about 3 years, and we're doing great. We are doing great. And I'd bought her a little car. She turned 16, bought her this little car. It's just a little car, pretty much a crap car. It's one of these cars that when you step on the gas, it just makes more noise. It doesn't go faster, you know. But she's not a very good driver. She got thick glasses, and she bangs on curbs. And I figured she couldn't get hurt in it, you know. And so, but I had a really cool car, this little hot rod. And one night she comes to me and she says, "Dad, can Kristen and I take your car?" It's a beautiful night. She wants to put the top down, go cruising. Damn, she's been so good for so long, you know. It's just hard to say no. And so, you know, okay, be careful. Be careful, sweetie. And away they go. You know, and they haven't been gone a half hour. Bing! "Dad, I was going too fast and I crashed the car." "You okay? Is Kristen okay? Can you drive the car? Where you at?" Where they're not supposed to be. "Stay right there. I'll be right there." I put the phone down and, man, I'm, for the first time in my sobriety, all bets are off. The little bitch is dead. Okay? Screw the promises. You know, that's my car. You know, anything but my car. And so I go out and I get in her little piece of crap. And it ain't going fast enough to get there. I'm about to pull the steering wheel off this thing, you know, and the little tachometer's just a revving and it ain't going nowhere. I'm pissed because I know I'm going to be driving it for a while. And I'm playing that conversation over in my head the way we do, and I hear her say, "Dad, I was going too fast, and I crashed the car." And I heard it. I heard it. I heard what she said. She said, "Dad, I was going too fast, and I crashed the car." She did the unheard of in a family like mine. She told the truth. She didn't make an excuse. She didn't tell a lie. She didn't dodge it. She just said, "Dad, I was going too fast, and I crashed the car." You know, she had learned to trust me. I had become trustworthy. I had become her loving father and had been her loving father for a while. And she knew that no matter what she did, she believed in her heart that I was going to love her. Now, when I was doing what she was doing, I told my dad, "Dad, a deer ran out in front of me and I swerved to miss it." And my dad beat the hell out of me. "Didn't I tell you to be careful? Didn't I? Don't you know what that's going to do to insurance? Don't you know how important that car is to this family?" And he damn near beat me to death. And that night I was able to go to Holly and comfort her. Comfort her. You see, she knows what that car means to me. And she knows what it's going to do to insurance. And she knows she was supposed to be careful. She's dying. She has disappointed the one man in the world she most wants to please. She's dying. Isn't that a great time to go whip your kid's ass? You know, when they're dying. That's the way I grew up. When I most needed someone's support, I got a strap. When I most needed some praise, I got criticism. Well, it's not that way in my house anymore. And Holly and I have grown close. Holly's 28 today, and we're tight. And I have a granddaughter by Holly, and we're tight, and I love it. You know, we talk to each other on the phone. We have a wonderful relationship. I walked her down the aisle when we got married, and I promise you, when I got sober, we were estranged. You know, I live in a world that I didn't know existed. It says in a long version of surrender prayer, God will make everything right if only we'll surrender to Him. And He has for me. Everything's been made right. The guilt I felt over my brother's death has been taken away. The anger I had towards my father has been taken away. The pain I've known with my disability has been taken away. I lost my hip and I lost my ankle. And when they tried to put them together, I had a horrible bone infection called osteomyelitis. And it wouldn't heal and it was very painful. And I lived with pain for years and years and years. I had pus that drained out of my buttocks for the first 7 years, and it would keep coming back. And I just had chronic pain, and I couldn't work, and I couldn't bend. I didn't have any joints. And when I would sit, is this going to be hot? When I would sit, I'd sit like this because I couldn't bend. And I was like this for 28 years. I couldn't sit in the back seat of a car. I couldn't ride a bicycle. I couldn't sit in a conventional toilet. Matter of fact, I'd go to a lot of places and there wouldn't be enough room for me to get over the toilet because I can't bend that leg to get it out of the way so that I can get down. In my home, I have all custom furniture. Everything's bar height. In my dining room table and everything's bar height, so I can just sit on it like this, so I don't have to bend. And they had told me that if I could ever go 10 years, without infection, that I'd be a candidate for a prosthetic hip. But I could never go more than a couple of years, and the pus and the infection and the pain would come back, and I'd end up in the hospital and with antibiotics, and there wasn't a doctor anywhere that would touch me. I mean, I'm just too prone to infection. But you know what? 10 years sober, I've been 10 years without infection. Isn't that amazing? Now, I used to think that I took the pills and I did the drinking to ease the pain. But what I found out was that because I drank and because I ate so many pills, I constantly injured myself and created the pain. And anybody who's having a problem with medications, you know, the pain doesn't go away until the pills are gone, I can promise you. But today, you know, I had a doctor who was willing to take a chance, and it didn't go smoothly, but after several surgeries, I got me a hip today. You know, and I can't tell you, I'm pain-free. And for after 28 years of chronic pain, I'm pain-free. And I'm here to tell you that God loves me best, okay? And there is nothing that He won't do to make sure that I enjoy my sobriety. It's very simple, that God loves me, He wants me to be sober and like it. And I truly do like and enjoy my sobriety. My life just keeps getting better. I want you to know there's nothing better than sitting on the toilet. You ever think you'd applaud for a guy sitting on a can? Look here, I can put my elbows on my knees. Isn't this great? Watch this. Watch this. I hadn't touched that foot with my own hands in 28 years. And today I can tie my own shoe. It's amazing. God is truly good. Everything's been made right. How long have I talked? 63 minutes.
You guys are getting off easy.
Two more stories. Can I tell two stories? God has a sense of humor. And the way we learn, He's been teaching me all along. I never know where it's coming from. I bought a little dog, and I wanted to teach her to catch a frisbee. I always thought if I had a frisbee-catching dog, then I'd be happy. You know, frisbee-catching dog has got to be a girl magnet, okay? You go to the park, you throw the frisbee, and the dog comes back with the frisbee and a whole bunch of girls. That's the way I saw it. And so I got this little spaniel, and I'm out in the yard throwing the frisbee, trying to teach her to catch it. And she's fetching, she ain't catching, she don't catch much better than I throw. And she's just a pup, you know, and so I'm trying to teach her to catch a frisbee. And this one day it was windy in Oklahoma, as it oftentimes is, and I throw the frisbee, and it goes up on the roof of the house. Well, I don't have a ladder. And my best thinking at the time was, well, I'll put Speeder up there and she'll go get it. Made sense to me, okay? I didn't think, how am I going to get her down? But anyway, I boosted this little spaniel up and I put her, it's a low roof. I put her front paw on the roof and my hand on her ass and I boosted her up. And I said, go get it, girl, go get it. Well, she didn't go get it. What she did was she got scared. And when she got scared, she peed. And she just peed all down the front of my face and all down my clothes. And I set her down on the ground and I started to laugh at myself. I couldn't believe I was going to do something that stupid. And I went in and called my sponsor. Johnny, you won't believe what God just did. I was going to put Speeder on the roof, and God made her pee on my head so I wouldn't do it. I don't know if God did that or not, but I believe He could. And I think you should go to the club and tell everybody. And I did. I ran up there and I was all excited what God had done for me. And I was telling that story to him in the meeting. And you ever do it where you hear yourself say something you didn't know you were going to say? I'm sharing that story and I hear myself say, I put her down on the ground and I started to laugh at myself. My old behavior would have been to kill the damn dog. And boy, that hit me hard. Because see, that was not a figure of speech. No way. I had brutalized and battered my pets my whole adult life. I always had big, mean dogs, Doberman Pinschers. My dogs would go through glass storm doors trying to get the mailman. They were mean because I made them mean. And I loved my dogs. But you know what? I was just like my dad. My father didn't know how to deal with his emotions. He didn't know how to deal with his anger. He didn't know how to deal with his frustration and his rage. He had no tools, no skills. And so it all would be stuffed and stuffed and stuffed, and then it would come out sideways at the things he loved in a moment of rage. And he would hit my mother, and he would hit us kids. And I was just like my dad. I didn't know how to deal with my feelings. I didn't know what to do with them, and I'd stuff them and stuff them and stuff them and medicate them and medicate them, and then they'd come out in a moment of rage, and I would batter my pets. You know, if we don't recover, we repeat. You know, you can want to be different, but if you don't learn a different way, you ain't going to be different. But God's all-powerful. You know, each day I get up, God help me. Keep me sober today. Your will, not mine, be done. And He does for me those things I can't do for myself. And that day I put the dog down on the ground and laughed at myself. You see, He had changed me. And today I've got a little dog named Boogie. And Peter's gone, but Boogie ain't never been beat. And neither has Chassie or any of the other dogs that I've owned in my sobriety. So, you know, I just keep changing and my world keeps getting better. And that was a big part of me forgiving my father, too, was to know that, you know, he's just like me, he's just like you. We're all just doing the best we can. We're all the perfect product of all our perceived experiences, and there's nothing wrong. You know, God is in His heaven and all is right on earth. Sandy was saying last night that if something disturbs me, there's something wrong with me. You know, I just don't have all the information. I don't have all the truths. I don't know the whys and the what fors, and I think I should. But if I'll just surrender to the fact that God is and that God is good and that all is as it's supposed to be, then my task is just to get in harmony with it, then I can know peace. And I've known peace for a long time. Everything's been made right for me, even Vietnam. Even the horrors of Vietnam have been made whole for me. I've been totally healed. I receive a disability compensation for my physical injuries, and I also receive a disability compensation for what they call post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, post-traumatic stress disorder is when you've got psychological problems revolving from some kind of a traumatic event, and we have what they call reoccurring intrusive thoughts. They're thoughts that you don't want, you wish would go away, but they're reoccurring and they continue to intrude into our lives. And I had a lot of reoccurring intrusive thoughts from Vietnam, the images of the horrors of combat in Vietnam. And one night I sat down to watch 2020 on a Friday night like I oftentimes do. I'd been to the races, but I came home and I just decided I'd watch TV that night. And I turned on the TV and lo and behold, 2020 was starting at 9 o'clock. It's an ABC news program and Barbara Walters and Hugh Downs host it. And the first little vignette that came on was called The Gift of Life. And as I sat there watching this program unfold, I couldn't believe my eyes, because what it was a story about a guy writing a book. He was writing a book about emergency room traumas, and he was interviewing one of the top trauma specialists in the nation, and he asked this doctor, what was your worst trauma case? What was the worst emergency room trauma you ever handled? And he began to recount when he was a young surgeon at the 71st Medevac in Pleiku, Vietnam, in September of 1968. And they brought in a soldier who was so gravely wounded that the consensus was to medicate him, set him aside, declare him expectant, and let him die. You see, his legs were blown off. Pieces of his arms are blown off. He's got shrapnel the size of your thumb in the middle of his brain. Both of his eyes are gone. I mean, save him for what? You know, this guy is screwed. Let him die. But Dr. Swan went against the consensus and he operated on this young soldier and he saved his life. And I'm sitting on the sofa just kind of uneasy, you know? so they, the guy asked Dr. Swan, well, what happened? How did he turn out? Did you make the right decision? Did you save him for a life of some value, or did you save him for a life of horror? I mean, he's pretty screwed up. And Dr. Swan didn't know. He'd never followed up. So they set about to find him. And they searched for 2 years before they tracked him down. And his name's Ken, and he's a Georgia boy. He lives in Georgia. And when they went to find him, what they found was that Ken's pretty cool. Not only has he survived, but he's married since Vietnam. And here's a guy who's got no eyes, he's got no legs. He's really brain damaged bad. I mean, his brain is fried. But now his injuries are severe. You know, he's lost fingers. He's lost pieces of his arms. They've had to put one arm back on backwards so that it would work. He can only feel with two fingers. And yet he's married. And he's fathered 2 children. And he has his own sailboat. And he sails. And he scuba dives, you know. I mean, I don't know if you know it or not, but people with no legs float. They tie weights on this guy and drag him under, you know. I mean, he's really a charismatic guy. He's special. And they start telling his story. And he was in a helicopter trying to drop firefighting equipment to infantrymen pinned down in the jungle on September 21st, 1968. And I sat on that sofa and I just went to pieces. I mean, I went to pieces. Pat came over and sat down and hung on to me and said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" I said, "I think this is my guy. I said, I think this is my story. This is my nightmare. This is my PTSD. This is my trauma. This is him. This is my story." I mean, I was just shaking. So I said about afterwards, you know, they're talking about Kenny and yeah, he's got a life and he's got a wife and he's doing amazing things, but he still suffers. He suffers from post-traumatic stress and he suffers from Vietnam. He has a hard time. Vietnam pretty much consumes him and it's about all he can talk about and think about. And he can't seem to get home from Vietnam. There's a lot of veterans that can't get home from Vietnam. You know, they still reside in there. And one of the things that bothers him is he doesn't know what happened to him that day. Well, you know, I was looking right at him, and I know what happened. So I thought, well, I'll try to get a hold of him and let him know if I can help. And I called Dr. Swan. Dr. Swan called me, or Dr. Swan called Ken, and Ken called me. And he didn't believe I was who I said, but I could prove it. And that started a relationship between Ken and I, and I began to try to help Ken get back from Vietnam. You know, I had, when I did my 4-step, I refused to go to Vietnam. You know, that was one of the reasons I didn't want to do a 4-step. I didn't want to go back to Vietnam. And my sponsor told me I didn't have to. He says, you know, just get a pencil and write down everybody that pisses you off. I could do that. But what happened was the Gulf War rolled around at about 7 years or 5 years sober, and the Gulf War mandated me back into some kind of therapy. And I had to take a look at Vietnam. And I had gotten some help with these steps and with some counseling. I had gotten some help and I had gotten pretty much comfortable with my Vietnam experience. And I thought, well, maybe I can help Ken do the same thing. So I'm talking to Ken on the phone and I'm listening to him and we're sharing. And as I'm trying to help him get out of the jungle and come back home and answer his questions, well, he's dragging me back in and taking me places I don't want to go. He's reminding me of things that I don't want to remember. He knows the names of those guys we put in the bags. You know, to me they were just corpses, but he knows their names. He remembers the numbers, the helicopter numbers. He remembers everything. And he was dragging me through hell. I'm trying to help him, and he's dragging me through hell, and I'm pissed. You know, I don't know. Did you ever work with a newcomer that you didn't like? You know, and you're just doing it because you know you're supposed to, but he's a real shit, you know? So anyway, you know, my intentions were good. I wanted to help Ken, but Ken is killing me. And I had no idea. I called my sponsor. I'm sure some of you all have done this, where you call your sponsor and you go, you know, Johnny, what's God doing? What is God doing? Why is this happening? You ever do that? If you've got a good sponsor like mine, the answer is always the same.
I don't know. You didn't tell me.
So anyway, you know, I'm trying to figure it out. And in my mind, what I had justified was that, you know, there's pictures of Ken with his babies when he was young. And that I'm going to replace the horrible images of war with the images of this guy holding his baby. That's what's going to happen. I'm going to get these new images. Well, that ain't what happened. What happened was Ken drug me back into the jungles on that telephone, and I had all kinds of new horrible images. And I got angry, and I had a resentment. And I didn't know what to do with that anger. I didn't know what it was all about. And it began to manifest in a real simple thing. You know, Every time I'd talk to Ken on the phone and we'd hang up, he never told me thank you. You know, it became an issue for me. You know, this guy has never thanked me for saving his life. It was no small feat. I'm decorated for heroism that day, and this son of a bitch can't even say thank you. I drug him through the fire, put tourniquets on his leg, and he don't give a damn. I was pissed, and every time we'd hang up, another conversation with no thank you, and I'm just getting madder and madder and madder. Finally, he asked me to send him some stuff. They're writing a book or doing something about his life. And I said, okay. And so I'm going to send him some memorabilia and stuff. And I put a cover letter on it. And in this cover letter I wrote, Ken, I've got a resentment. You've never told me thank you for saving your life. I thought, God, I got it out. All right. But I made the mistake of showing it to Pat. She hadn't done that. She looks at it and she goes, what's this here? What's this? What's this you never said thank you stuff? That doesn't belong in there. I said, oh, yes, it does. It's the truth, and I live in the truth. She says, isn't there a spiritual axiom? You know, something about if something bothers you, there's something wrong with you. Yeah. I just hate it when she's right, you know. I'm kind of like having a pigeon call you on your stuff, you know. Anyway, so I went back to my word processor to edit it out. And what came out was finally the answer to my question, you know, why is God doing this? And what came out was the truth that I'd been missing my whole adult life. And the truth was, as I tried to edit that letter so that I didn't rewrite it, what came out was, Ken, I've never said thank you. And that was the first time in my adult life that I had given any consideration to the fact that Ken was safe in a helicopter. I'm pinned down in a burning jungle. Ken flies into harm's way for me, to help me. And when that rocket hit that helicopter, he gave his legs and he gave his sight and he entered into that darkness and that disability for me. And no one had ever told him thank you. Thank you, Ken, for your sacrifice. Selfish, self-centered, that's the root of my problem. See, I suffer from a bias and a prejudice of self. I see the world through a biased set of eyes. Me, 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 me. You'd think I was a damned opera singer. Yeah. Me, 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 me. When I was able to tell Ken thank you for his sacrifice, my whole world changed. The weights were lifted off of me. You know, things became right. God is in his heaven and all is right on earth. Ken and I began a journey that's lasted 9 years. We're tight. How long since you've had a drink, Ken? A little over 10 years. I'd like for you all to meet. I'd like for you all to meet an amazing man. My best friend, and somebody Georgia can truly be proud of, Ken McGarity. And Ken, again, I thank you for your sacrifice. This is good. Anyway, I hope you guys will say hi to Ken. He's a hell of a guy. He's worth knowing. Another gift to this program. God will make right everything if only we'll surrender to Him. You know, I think my life's just one big miracle. And it all started in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's no reason why that if you've got a problem, God can't handle it. I don't know how, and I don't know when, but for me it's been real simple. You know, I go to meetings, I don't drink, I clean up the mess that I've made, and I try to help others. And while I'm doing that, God does for me what I can't do for myself. Thanks for letting me come and share with you.